Let us strive every moment of our lives to make ourselves better and better to the best of our ability, so that all may profit by it. Let us think of the right and lend our assistance to all who may need it, with no regard for anything but justice. Let us take what comes with a smile, without loss of courage. Let us be considerate of our country, our fellow citizens, and our associates in everything we say and do. Let us do right to all, and wrong no man.
Yeah, well, there we are. We came out of the first hour of the program, or part one of Midweek Drive, with a whole range of things about the future and indeed what's the world going to be like in 2040. Interesting. Okay, will you still love me? Will you still need me when I'm 64? I just have to go back to that whole side of things. We have Jessica Burtis, so we have Kathy Manso with us. In the background, we have Black Adam, which is a hero you may not be familiar with. Or are you, Kathy Manso?
I'm not familiar with, I will be honest.
No, Jessica Burtis, are you familiar with Black Adam?
I'm not, but I've seen like the posters around the city for it.
Yeah, and that's in Dublin, of course. Well, if you actually go to the current edition of SFX magazine, which I shall just wave to the camera at this particular stage, and you work your way through to page 84, you see Rock, I say again, Rock of Ages. I'm thinking, finally, they've got around to doing a tribute to the Tom Cruise movie. No, it's Black Adam, but written by the awesome Richard Edwards, former SFX editor. Richard, welcome back to the Midweek Drive. How are you? He'll be fine once he gets his microphone working and he doesn't unmute himself. Otherwise, we'll just sort of lip read and we'll get our things sorted on that basis. And I'll say
perfect
again.
Radio, right? Hello.
Yes. Strangely enough, this time around, Richard, due to slight technicalities, we're still in the temporal vortex of Zoom and Siren, as our transmitter is having one or two challenges. So we thought we'll carry on regardless, and this will be going out at a later date, or for the podcast listener, as an extra added bonus, which is great stuff there. So it's all happening. So share with us then. We launched this particular program with... or this particular segment, with what I regard as probably the finest soliloquy in the history of motion pictures. I am, of course, referring to Ron Ely's incarnation of Doc Savage in the 1975 George Powell movie. And for many years, this was the role of which Dwayne Johnson seemed to be destined to play, a genuine superhero, a precursor. It's going to be considered on Resonance Rewind and working through that. And yet, of course, he throws us a complete wobbly and decides to incarnate as Black Adam instead. So let's start off by talking Black Adam, Justice Society of America, Dr. Fate, played by Pierce Brosnan. What's not to love? How did you get on with this particular feature on SFX magazine?
Oh, it was good. I mean, it's obviously we're not short of superhero stuff to write about at the moment.
Really?
it's just like it's everywhere. This is, of course, I mean, DC, who are not, you would argue, are not doing quite as well as Marvel in the superhero stakes on the screen. And they're really making a pitch for making this a little bit different. The idea that he's more an anti-hero than a hero, that he doesn't really think twice if people die. I mean, this is apparently a role that Dwayne Johnson, aka The Rock, has wanted to play for a long, long time. I mean, originally he was going to be appearing alongside Shazam, which would have been very different. I mean, they both originated in Fawcett comics even before they were brought into DC. I think it was decided though that, you know, they were two big characters, and that they, you know, it wasn't enough movie to have them together. Also, I don't think you'd get Dwayne Johnson that often appearing in a movie where he's not number one. It's going to be really interesting to see how it pans out, because you've got the Justice Society of America in it, who are like a forerunner of the Justice League with superheroes who we don't really know. And we're getting the sense that they're going to sort of, be working against Black Adam to start off with. But I have a feeling there might be something else come into this that makes it seem, makes Black Adam have to turn to the side of good.
I'm amazed you actually said the S word there and didn't actually convert yourself into the superhero of Solomon, Hercules, Achilles, Zeus, Atlas, and Mercury. But you did. So obviously the power is there, or maybe it's sort of the strangeness of the world, etc. Kathy,
I'm more worried about saying Candyman. Actually,
that's true. That is true. That's a fair point. Yeah, and yeah, you said it. We just said it once, so let's not say it again. Okay.
No, I don't.
Exactly. You see, horrendous for that line of things. Kathy, has that given you a little insight into this particular role? Because there are people, of course, who say, forget Doc Savage, forget Black Adam. Dwayne Johnson surely should be the person who replaces Joe Biden in the presidency.
True. Absolutely correct. it definitely does. And I kind of like the concept that he's not really caring about the other people involved, which is something that isn't really point out in superheroes. I mean, we've had it attempted a few
times. Ideal for the President of the United States, of course.
Sure, yeah. But I kind of like the idea of like actually dealing with the consequences of like everyday life. Like, hey, this is kind of, to say the least, more than annoying when a superhero has to do anything possible to get the job done. And then they doesn't realize the infrastructure damage, for example, or things like that.
It's like The Boys, and they just wreck their whole civil liberties entirely. You need to have full cleanup squads to actually just deal with the mess that's being caused by these titanic clashes that we're seeing there. I mean, it's bad enough when you see She-Hulk twerking on screen without getting any further down that line, but still, that's a different perspective. And don't get me started on Daredevil and his latest relationship with respect to Jessica from She-Hulk. But that's a different franchise anyway. Let's stay with DC. Jessica, what about yourself? Any thoughts or questions for Richard, who, as I say, has written this quintessential article on the Black Adam movie, Words, Richard Edwards? It's quite frankly the best 6 pages you could ever wish to actually experience. I'd immediately sort of say you should get a rise from Future Publishing just for that alone, Richard, on that basis. I mean, the Doctor Who article that follows it is interesting, but, you know, I'm just saying. Anyway, Jessica.
Yeah, I want to know, like, how you picked where to start with this article, like how to go about writing about this character.
That's a really interesting question, actually, because that's how do you write, it's almost like how you write any feature. I mean, you kind of, it often lends itself, what the interviews you get kind of lends itself to it, and what people say, and hopefully they'll say something interesting enough that it kind of becomes an angle, or, you know, you'll find a lead in, just a way in that's a hook. So it usually starts with a hook, and then it's kind of a case of looking at what quotes you've got, what's most important to get in there, and trying to get it into some kind of coherent order.
But do you find that like it's easier to write about superhero or just like sci-fi characters than other types?
It depends on the character. I mean, for example, I mean, I've written a lot about Star Wars and Star Trek, and that's that becomes a little bit, you get very familiar with that, and that's great because you know the little nuances, little bits of the universe. I think with superhero stuff, as ditto Star Wars and Star Trek, there's just so much of it. That's the thing to be aware of, and how things sort of interlink, and that there's always a history there. You know, and often it's a case of, as well as talking about a new movie, condensing that backstory in there to a point where for someone like Black Adam, for example, who is a character who goes back to, I think, to the 40s, but not that many people are aware of him. You know, comic book fans love him. You know, he's become a big star, but he's not like Batman or Spider-Man, where, you know, kids walk around with him on a lunchbox.
Is it hard? Sorry. I was just going to ask, like, is it hard sometimes trying to sift through like what is kind of considered canon and what might not be? Because I know, like, especially with comics, there can be like some type of comics where fans will say, oh, that's not canon, or this is different. So have you ever run into that issue, especially with a character as old as Black Adam?
I mean, I think it's a bigger challenge for the people writing the film. I think there's that much there, and people do get, I guess, very protective of canon. I'm very much of the opinion that, you know, you try to stick with canon, but there are going to be contradictions, because when people were writing, you know, when they got people were writing the first series of Star Trek, for example, they were writing individual episodes of Star Trek. They weren't thinking, you know, 55 years time, people are going to be making 5-6 TV shows simultaneously that will refer back to a line that Spock said here. You know, that it was a different kind of writing. Things do contradict. Doctor Who, an utter nightmare of canon. I mean, there are contradictions everywhere. And, you know, you look at something like for Star Wars, for example, you know, where people try and explain away just the tiniest little things, you know, or there's a guy in Empire Strikes Back who's carrying a thing that looks like an ice cream maker. So he was referred to as the ice cream man for years. And then someone created a whole backstory. So now he has a name and he has a history. But really, I mean, he was an extra with a prop. So you know, canon is a kind of weird thing. And it's like, yeah, you respect it. But I think there's a time where you just have to say, it's okay. There will be a contradiction here because, you know, it's fictional. And you know, it's not like history. Well, I suppose history is also open to interpretation. So then you get onto all sorts of philosophical
Richard,
questions.
Surely the word is multiverse. Surely that is the word.
Oh my God. Well, yeah, multiverse. That's the sort of thing that can break your head. I mean, you know, you go into the Marvel Cinematic Universe, think, well, at least this is kind of linear. This is fine. You know, one thing happens after another. Then it's multiverses. They're all happening parallel. People are jumping across. I mean, our brains are not built to handle that.
Which is pretty much what Einstein said. I am delighted, though, to actually see we have a full incarnation of Carter Hall's alter ego, Hawkman, does actually appear in Blackadder. And of course, one of the questions I think you might have put, which is the Hawkman suit practical or CG?
Yes. And it's Aldous Hodge said a lot of it is practical, which is brilliant. I mean, it sounds like a nightmare to walk around in. And I think you could have a lot of problems turning around and knocking someone out with your wings.
That's why you have a mace, Richard. You have a mace that you kind of slice and dice with. That's the clear sort of aspect of Hawkman, surely, his mace.
Yes. So, well, I think it's wonderful that they are making these things practically now, because there was such a move, I guess, at the turn of the century to make everything CG, you know, do background CG, recreate everything. But now you've got this tangible stuff. It is great because they can do pretty much anything now. You know, there's, you know, you can have things, you can have monsters doing a pretty good approximation of walking, which because they can remove the puppeteers afterwards with CG, so it's great.
We've recently celebrated, of course, a Terrahawks Day, 10/10, 10th of October. Jamie Anderson, very excited about that. Very much speaking on behalf of obviously the needs to enhance and develop the multiverse and so on. Do you think that maybe we need to almost rethink this and go back from all these multiverses, all these things happening simultaneously and taking place in their own way, to maybe getting more linear storytelling, where we actually just say, look, let's just focus on the storytelling. Let's not worry about whether we're from ancient Egypt or indeed with a reincarnation of several hundred years, etc. Let's just work on that basis. Or is it a case of, no, bring it on?
I think multiverses is something where we're not actually sure how it's going to play out, because Marvel's kind of hinting at it at the moment. Obviously, Marvel Universe is already huge, but it's kind of the first of the big universes to do multiverses in a big way. I mean, Star Trek's done its mirror universes, but that happens quite rarely. And
I gather a crossover between Lower Decks and Strange New Worlds,
yes,
is in the pipeline.
Which I'm quite curious to see how they do that, because I like both shows. But with Star Trek, their technique for sort of the mirror universe is really to have exactly the same characters, just have one universe's versions being evil, which is, of course, signified by a goatee beard, usually. So that's very different to what Marvel's attempting. And, you know, how they keep control of that and how the viewers can sort of keep track of what's going on, and also to do it in a way that doesn't necessarily diminish what's already been done in the existing universe, because you could easily say, oh yeah, we want to bring back a character who has died. I was going to say something then, and I was like, well, that's 3 years ago, but is I don't know, does that count as a spoiler now? But if someone has died, there's no the reason you can't bring them back in a from a parallel universe, but then does that diminish the death in the original universe? So yeah, all sorts of questions to ask there.
Richard, I think already we need to start the campaign. Bring back Jessica Fletcher as Angela at Lansbury. She needs to actually be CGI'd into the next Marvel Universe thing. We need Jessica Fletcher. I'm just saying. Kathy, thoughts from yourself?
Yeah, I have a question. I was kind of curious. Well, I have a lot of questions, but I'm going to go with the one that's recently on my mind. And I was wondering, is there a character or comic book character or novel character that you think of that you either wish to see made into a film or hope to never see made into a film?
God, that's one that needs preparation.
You're right. That's true.
I'm gonna have to think about that. I always want. It was made into a TV show in the 80s. I'd quite like to see a movie of the Tripods, which book series that I liked as a kid. I mean, it would need a lot of modernization, because if you read it now, it is very much of its time. But this idea of these giant machines coming down and enslaving human race, basically. These tripods as gods, and then the kids who kind of have to overthrow them. That would make a good story.
The TV series did try. It got there for two seasons, and then they ran out of money. It just happened.
Yeah, what a shame. But I mean, also, I think the books were not made for a TV series. That they were the length of the books was good for a movie. They were really stretched out. So I think that's got potential. The thing is, though, now I think so many of the big franchises or the things that have potential have been picked up already, because, you know, Hollywood and TV know are always on the lookout. And I think as well that now that TV has become arguably bigger than films, there's so many things where people have said, you know, for example, like Game of Thrones, that would, you know, too long for a film, but you can tell it over the length of a TV show. So yeah, so much has been picked up. That is a really good question that I have dodged completely.
You know, got to ask those kind of questions. Just curious.
Oh, if I was asking someone else, I'd be very happy with myself. But
are we living in a golden age of fantasy and fandom? I mean, obviously, Kathy and Jessica are regular contributors to Resonance Rewind. One day, Richard, you'll come on the show. Maybe you'd like to talk about Doc Savage this week. But in terms of a whole range of aspects, you know, I can't recall a time where there's been so much product that's going out. I mean, your Marvel, your DC, your Star Wars, your Star Trek. I mean, we've got Star Trek Prodigy. We've got Star Trek Lower Decks. We've got Star Trek Strange New Worlds. We've got the fifth season of Discovery. We've got Star Trek Picard. I mean, is it a case of people might sort of think, this is like, you know, the science fiction equivalent of Jessica Burtis's sweet tea. It's as much sugar as you can pack in. It's humanly possible.
There's never been as much. I mean, there is no question about that. I mean, I don't think there has ever been as, even if you take genre out of it, there has never been so much TV or films being made. Well, no, films maybe not, but certainly TV. I mean, you've got, on top of the traditional broadcast networks, you've got Netflix, you've got Disney Plus, you've got Paramount Plus, you've got all of these channels, and they're all trying to make content to make people want to subscribe. And for now, at least, because I think we're probably getting to a point where there aren't enough eyes in the world to sustain them all. But for now, they're going to keep throwing the money in. And also, now you've got, say, Netflix going out and making a big TV show, and they've got the budgets to do justice to it. Whereas perhaps if the BBC was making this adaptation, they wouldn't be able to spend quite so much. So there isn't anything now on TV that you can't do on TV that you could do in movies. I mean, look at the new Lord of the Rings show. I mean, okay, Amazon money, it's funded by one of the richest people on the planet, but the stuff they are doing in that show is so ambitious. I mean, it's huge. And that's happening on TV, which would have been, 15 years ago, that would just not have been possible.
SFX has been going for quite some considerable time now, and as you can see, Richard, I'm embracing my inner raccoon for this to actually demonstrate the importance of avatar structures, just in case we ever actually do launch the Midweek Drive as a series of videos on YouTube. I'm just dropping that in there as a possibility. But is it something which, when you look back, I mean, you come to it as a fan, you was editor-in-chief, obviously, of SFX. I mean, Dave Bradley was there for... Now, of course, it's looked after by the wonderful Darren Scott, who needs to come back to the show, obviously. But in terms of all of those sort of aspects, go back to SFX's early days. I mean, is this something that you would have predicted? I mean, one of the lines that I think Dave Golder once said to us, actually students at the University of Lincoln actually heard Dave utter these very words. He said, "The geeks shall inherit the earth." Has that happened?
I think it probably has. Yeah, I think, I mean, when I was on SFX, say, when I started in 2006, I think it was, you know, someone would make a TV show and it would be vaguely science fiction, and it would, like, by default, you'd write about it almost, you know, because it was of interest, because it was... Crime Traveller, yes. That was actually before my time, so I don't have to take any responsibility for Crime Traveller, but yes. The infamous Crime Traveller, but yeah, the just wasn't as much, and certainly not of the scale. And I think there's been a sea change. I think the big thing, perhaps over the last 15 years, is that a lot of the people making shows are actually, let's say the Star Wars generation. So they're people who grew up, you know, had a life changing experience as kids watching Star Wars. It's not just the people making it; it's the people who are commissioning it. And I think for so many years, science fiction was almost commissioned by people who didn't really know what made good stuff. So after Star Wars, you got a lot of not brilliant sci-fi fantasy movies, because it's like, well, let's give it a try. Kids just like space. And there was a lot
more
to it. Are
you saying Battle
that.
Beyond the Stars is not worthy of Academy Award retrospective consideration? I mean, you know, surely. Sybil Danning in one of her finest roles.
Well, exactly. Well, yeah, I mean, there are always exceptions. So, I mean, I was being very general. But I think over now, I think a lot more is, just want of a better word, good. And because there's a lot of people who are fans, and then you've got a big audience for it. And in a way that perhaps science fiction, fantasy were seen as almost like the area of the geek, or sort of looked down on. Now everyone's a geek. You know, that everyone likes, has a bit of Star Wars. Everyone's watching Stranger Things and things. So, yeah, I think there has just been a big cultural change, both in terms of audiences and in terms of the people making it. And so also the rise of special effects have really helped them.
One of our now fairly regular contributors, of course, is Matthew Jacobs. And of course, he's co-directed and co-produced incarnation of Doctor Who Am I, is reviewed in the latest edition of SFX by Ian Berryman. I thought it was a bit harsh on it, but then that's because I think Matthew's become a friend of the show, etc. But probably when we discussed this with Matthew is, thank God the internet wasn't around as such, or at least there wasn't Twitter, Facebook, and all the rest of the hate channels when he was actually making Doctor Who, the movie, and he wrote that, because he would have been excoriated. Is it tougher in some instances where social media channels can literally, as is the case with Amazon Prime's Lord of the Rings, almost eviscerate the movie before it's even been seen?
Oh, I think it is a big problem. And I think this doesn't necessarily just apply to movies and TV, though. I think this social media is just can be a very horrible place, and people can be abusive, and people don't have a filter, and people just criticize stuff. And a lot of the criticism that's been leveled at Lord of the Rings,
Star Trek Discovery.
Yeah, you know, it is people sort of having a worldview that is...
Ms. Marvel, She-Hulk,
the list just goes on. And, you know, sexist, racist comments, and it's horrible. And, yeah, I mean, it's social media. It isn't sort of just limited to movies, TV, but it does make it a minefield. It's horrible.
I just hope Janet Fielding and Sophie Aldred are actually ready for the response they'll obviously get to their part in the ending of the Jodie Whittaker era of Chris Chibnall's Doctor Who, and of course the ending of Chris Chibnall's era as well, which is intriguing. Maybe we'll look back in about 30 years' time and say, oh, it was great, really. Anyway, that's another line. Jessica, back to yourself. Any thoughts from your own perspective as somebody who isn't on Facebook, and quite rightly so? Why would you want to be tagged into every midweek drive thing? It's not appropriate, you know. I mean, I do this show, I take the shots, and inevitably within a couple of hours, Richard will find himself tagged in. Kathy will be tagged in. You think, I didn't sign up for this. Well, where's my lawyer? Go for it, Jessica.
I was wondering if there are any characters you remember or any comics like when you were kind of young that had a massive impact on you and kind of your interest in this.
Kind of young, Richard, because obviously those days are long gone, clearly.
Sure, I don't know. I know people get into comics like at different times, so whenever that formative time was.
I think with comic stuff, it was, the big thing for comics for me, I think, was the 90s X-Men and Spider-Man TV shows, because I was aware of the, you know, characters a bit earlier than that, but I think the X-Men cartoon, I think used to show on Saturday morning TV, was just, it kind of captured, I think, a lot of what I learned was important to Marvel, with the kind of interconnectivity of characters and long-running stories. And I think it's very easy for sort of parents and things to say to you, oh, it's just, you know, cartoons, kids stuff, and actually you're watching this thinking there's quite a lot going on here. Characters quite interesting. It's quite interesting themes. Things are recurring, you know, many, many episodes down the line. So I think that was a big one. I mean, in terms of science fiction and just pop cultural interest, I think it was Star Wars. I mean, it's such a cliche, but I must have been about four when the original movie was on TV, and I just seeing the droids. I could just remember the droids going up, walking through the desert. And I was kind of hooked. And after that, anything that had space in it, I just devoured. So I'd watch Star Trek. Even stuff that was completely unsuitable for a kid. I mean, I'm not sort of talking about like Alien or anything where it's violent and horrible. They're just like the Invaders, about a man who's looking for aliens who've got a weird little finger.
Hey, Richard, You've cited a classic show which we've reviewed not one, but two episodes of on Resonance Rewind. We did the opening episode, Beachhead, and then we followed that through with Jack Lord's incarnation in Vicar. I mean, you know, great stuff.
Yeah, well, that's it. But not ideal for a 6 or 7 year old, because what is going on here? What is this? So, but anything with space in, I just devoured. Yeah.
Needless to say, it leads on to the next question, which is favorite X-Man character or X-person, to be non-gender specific.
Ooh.
I mean, was it Hank McCoy's hairy blue beast? Was it indeed Wolverine? Was it Jubilee or Gambit? Was it indeed Storm? Could it be Professor X himself? Or the tragic figure, one of my early favorites, it has to be said, tying very much with Green Lantern in terms of all-time favorite comic superhero, Cyclops?
I'm gonna say Nightcrawler.
Really?
That's Bamf. That's sound effect.
That's Bamf, of course. Bamf and a smell, which we never got in the comics, the smell of brimstone. We got that strange sort of odor, but even in the TV series, you never got that smell of brimstone that was actually there. I mean, you might have got his you know, utterings of his Catholic background and the Verstehen Sie nicht, etc., and all sorts of other areas. Yes, Kurt Wagner, of course, the alter ego of Nightcrawler. Interesting. And before we actually leave it, Jessica actually recently encountered, I believe, Jessica, the writings of E.E. Doc Smith, creator of the classic Lensman series and Galactic Patrol. So have you started immersing yourself in the precursor to much of Star Wars and Star Trek, etc., in terms of the Lensmen and E.E. Doc Smith?
Not yet. I was, I've been reviewing old needlework books and teeny tiny Bibles, which has been taking up my attention for class, but I want to, because I've been going down a list and I'm kind of looking at formative sci-fi, like texts that really had like some of the first times where you'd see certain things, like the first time kind of cyborg was like coined, or the first kind of time that aliens were shown interacting with humans, and kind of trying to map out like the family tree of sci-fi. literature. So
That
I'm
to me
very.
sounds like a golden book Future Publishing should be haggling for the rights
Ooh,
immediately on, you know,
that's a good
the first
idea,
time.
Richard.
You got a new CEO coming into place. I mean, your old CEO is headed off. I mean, you should go for it, Richard. Become the next chief executive officer of Future Publishing. This is what we need.
Yeah, I'm not sure that's what they need.
Look, you could handle 442 as well as Total Film, as well as obviously SFX. So, I mean, I'm sure it would work, plus all the other great stuff that comes out of that. Kathy, any final closing thoughts of yourself? I'm still coming to terms with that notion of needlework, teeny tiny Bibles, and indeed SF. I mean, of course, we would have celebrated in much greater volume the Carol Chapek Rossum's Universal Robots, which is now over 100 years old, when his brother Joseph Chapek coined the term robot. It means serf in the original Czech language to actually talk about robots in general. Anyway, Kathy, over to you.
Well, I do have a final question for Richard. And this is, I mean, I feel like you probably have already thought about this. So I don't think it's a new question, but if you could be a superhero or a villain, you have to decide either one or the other. What would be your power and what would be your name?
That's going to embrace your inner geek, Richard. That's going to be a line to really work through that. It's awesome. You've got 30 seconds, no pressure, but we're just sort of giving you that time.
Okay, power. I would love to be able to, if you're talking to someone and it's sort of, you know, there's just awkward bits where you think the conversation's died, but you don't want to offend anybody, to
The
sort of
screen
sneak
has
out.
frozen.
So you can sneak out of that conversation without offending anybody and just being nice about it. So no one feels awkward. So
You could be
that would
called
be
the
my.
manipulator.
No,
You
it's
could
not
manipulate.
manipulation. It's meant to be nice.
It's sounding like more hero than villain. I think you're going
Definitely
with.
a hero, and you could also help other people in the same situation. And I guess
Facilitator.
the dodger probably.
I dig
Although Roger might
it.
be a bit annoyed about that, but that's DC Thompson, so we don't worry about the DC Thompson multiverse. They're already confused enough with talking bears. So it's another perspective. Extraordinary. We've had a little deep dive, which has been fun. So Jessica, last two questions for Richard Edwards, please. He might politely just not ignore them and pretend he's. Who knows? Jessica, over to you.
Yes, Richard, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us today?
I'd say better than reasonably interesting. I'd say very interesting.
Good.
High pressure questions as well.
Well,
We've really
I
reached
hope
that stage, Richard. You've graduated. You've gone through the sort of the easy, you know, you're into the postgraduate doctoral level now. This is important.
yes. If our questions haven't scared you away yet, will you come back soon?
I'll be better. I will be prepared next time for anything, probably.
Perfect. No problem.
Remember, Richard, as we celebrate, continue to celebrate Terrahawks Day, that expect the unexpected was Tiger Einstein's motto. And anything can happen in the next Zoomer.
Oh, you're mixing your Gerry Anderson now.
It's the multiverse. It was a Rob Zemeckis film, Back to the Future, that actually suggested you could use wearables in terms of technology and so on. And here we are into almost the second quarter of the 21st century, and it still hasn't arrived. But maybe it's on its way, with three quarters of children predicting that outfits will be able to decompose in the future, and indeed possibly transport us into different places as well, with flying shoes and so on. Now, to actually address some of the findings behind this, we're delighted to welcome from the Institution of Engineering and Technology, or IET. IET's very own Young Woman Engineer of the Year, the fabulous Dr. Kira McGrath. How are you, Kira?
I'm great. Thank you so much for having me.
Excellent. So, again, it's all about the fashion. We heard about wearables. That used to be, I think, one of the things that was put forward, that we won't be having mobile phones in future because everything will be worn upon our person. Is that something that ties into this particular study of 5 to 13-year-olds and their belief as to what we're going to see in the fashion industry over the next 40 years?
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, I think, Alex, like you said, we're starting to move towards that future already, aren't we? How many of us have smartwatches that we're carrying around that can monitor our heart rate, our fitness, our sleep? So we're already starting to see these wearables getting incorporated into our daily lives. And we've seen that a lot of kids are saying that that's the kind of image they have for the future. But really excitingly for me, actually, is that they're not necessarily thinking about wearables that, you know, can do silly things, you know, that'll let us play games on our watches or carry those things around. They're actually thinking about things that can help people and help the planet. So clothes that can biodegrade and leave no waste behind, clothes that can generate electricity, you know, and even things like bionic trousers that could help people with disabilities to walk. So I think it's really exciting to hear some of these ideas coming from kids today.
Exoskeletons, I suppose, would be coming into place with respect to bionic trousers, but that's another line and so on. I was particularly interested in the line of clothes that grow at the same rate as you and clothes which can also tell if you're getting ill. I mean, I suppose to a certain extent we have, with respect to smartwatches, things which will predict our mental and medical well-being, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely. And we're starting to see so much data being collected from people all around the world that, you know, we can start to see different trends and different things being developed. But I think it's really interesting when we think about the idea of clothes growing with us that you mentioned. I can imagine that's really convenient as well because you don't need to go shopping quite so often. But there's also a real sustainability element there about not needing to buy new clothes so frequently. And that's what we really saw in the studies that we were doing, was that kids really thought that it was far more important to have sustainable clothing rather than have clothes that simply looked cool. And I think that just goes to show how ambitious these kids are for the future and how important they think it is to tackle climate change.
And also that engineers can work in fashion and science combined from that point of view, which I think is something which many folk would say, no, I'm a fashionista, I'm not a scientist, but the two things can work very closely hand in hand. Bring us neatly round to, of course, this competition that the IET have put together, Backpack to the Future. Explain, Kira, how can people take part in this, or in particular, how can our youngsters between 5 and 13 design their own backpack for this situation?
Absolutely. So this competition is all about getting kids excited about engineering and putting that together with their idea of fashion. So we know that most kids get to pick the backpack that they wear to school. It's a fashion item they get to take with them and show off their style. And what we're giving them the opportunity to do now is to think about the future and what their perfect backpack for the future might be.
Closing date,
of course. So to enter the competition, sorry?
I was just going to say the closing date is the 30th of October, but how can people enter, Kira?
Absolutely. So the way they can enter is they have to draw their backpack design and send us a description of how it works. Those are all going to be judged by experts in the field. And then the winner's backpack will be prototyped by Hype and displayed in their flagship London store.
Absolutely outstanding. Dr. Kira McGrath, currently the IET's Young Woman Engineer of the Year. Can you enter it again? Can you become can it be a title that you actually go for again? Or is it a case of no, I've only got it for 1 year?
So we've actually already interviewed the people for our next Engineer of the Year. So please do keep an eye out for that. The new IET winner will be coming very, very soon. And for the kids who want to enter this Backpack to the Future competition, they can do that on the IET website as well. So that's www.engineer-a-better-world.org.
Dr. Kira McGrath, the IET's current Young Woman Engineer of the Year. Huge thanks and keep on keeping on.
Thanks so much.
It's perhaps one of the most regrettable aspects of the human condition that sometimes people can be unkind in the most odd sort of ways. And perhaps one of those oddest ways is when we start thinking about disability or differently enabled, etc. With a recent survey suggesting that the mental health of people with less visible disabilities is suffering as a result of being challenged as to whether they're using an accessible toilet, getting priority mandatory seating on public transport, blue badge parking, all of these things. We've seen people actually being challenged on the basis of they don't look disabled. Well, of course, disabilities can be invisible. And to actually address the challenges of this, we're delighted to welcome the medical director of Bupa UK. That's a wonderful Dr. Helen Hartley. How are you, Helen?
Good morning. Very well. Hope you are too.
Yeah, I mean, clearly we are both wearing spectacles. So in a sense, we are visually impaired. So from that point of view, we're disabled. That's clear from that point of view. People have a whole range, there's a whole continuum of disabilities. But this is really quite a disturbing survey insofar as, you know, clearly we don't know what our fellow sisters and brothers are actually challenged with. So to actually turn around and say, what are you parking there for? Can be quite problematic, I would have thought.
Yes, exactly. And research by Bupa and Scope has found that 83% of people with less visible disabilities have been challenged in that way when out and about using public transport, trying to use accessible toilets, etc. And it can be very distressing for them because clearly they don't want to break into a big description as to their personal medical condition. But I think sometimes we may have preconceived ideas as to what a disabled person looks like. And, you know, they don't necessarily sit in a wheelchair or carry a stick. And it's very important for them to be able to use the facilities that are available for them.
You mentioned, obviously, that the mental health, I mean, clearly we've just come out, I felt many people were still undergoing sort of the challenges of COVID-19, et cetera, but with the pandemic, is this getting worse? Was this something that was in existence beforehand? I mean, I seem to recall, certainly pre-pandemic, again, we had similar issues, but has it become a bigger problem over the last few months?
I think that's difficult to say. Because this survey is a snapshot, it could be that people are becoming less tolerant, or it might be that people are actually more mindful of the needs of disabled people, and perhaps they just are not aware that some disabilities are less visible. And I think really this piece of education is really important, because I think that the public, when realizing that some disabilities are less visible, I think people will show kindness and be more empathetic. And I think really it's just on all of us to be mindful that a person using disabled facilities may have very good reasons. And, you know, it's not for us to challenge, but if we do want to challenge, we should do it in a kind way and not in a way that makes them feel uncomfortable. We don't want to have people losing confidence to go out and about, you know, cutting themselves off, not interacting in their social life. We need to make society more inclusive for disabled people. And this partnership between Bupa and Paralympics GB is very important in achieving that, because we want more inclusiveness in society. We want better mental health for all, because the mental health impact of being challenged, you know, on a daily basis can be quite significant, and people can have increased anxiety, lower mood. You know, this can damage people's mental health, and 63% of those people with less visible disabilities actually report mental health impact from these day-to-day challenges. So it's very important that we adapt.
You've raised a number of key questions there. Indeed, I think there are five top tips that you've provided in terms of how people can actually cope with this. Number one, of course, is just be aware of the different types of disability that people are likely to be faced with. As I said, just because you can't actually see it doesn't mean to say that you're not dealing with somebody who is differently enabled, to actually change the vocabulary slightly.
Exactly, exactly. Greater awareness is important. I think also the language that we use, you know, to avoid any disrespectful language, and, you know, to become better allies, to think about how we can include disabled people in our work and social activities. And also, I think, very importantly, given the mental health impact, to be watching out for the signs, so that if we see any signs of mental ill health in ourselves or our disabled friends and family, that we can encourage each other to seek appropriate help and support. And obviously, we've all got our GP to go to. There are also mental health charities like Mind and the Samaritans who can offer great advice and support. And, you know, it's basically being aware and getting the help that people need in order to support them remain in a good mental space and able to participate fully in life and work.
and certainly championing inclusion and accessibility, as we say, comes very much to the fore of that. Where can people go to find out further details? They might have just caught part of this whilst listening to it on Siren Radio. They might sort of think, okay, fine, we want to find out further details. Where would you point them?
Well, there'll be information on the Bupa and Scope websites, and generally information about mental health from people's GPs and mental health charities, Mind and the Samaritans.
Dr. Helen Hartley, Medical Director of Bupa UK, huge thanks, and keep on keeping on.
Thank you very much.
Okay, fine. We've had a pandemic. We were working from home. We were getting used to working from home. Many people would say it's good for the environment to work from home. Now, of course, the pandemic is apparently all over. We're back to the office. And, of course, people are saying we should go back to the office and so on. And if you're confused, well, perhaps understandably so. But are there ways in which maybe, just maybe, we can start looking at different ways to impact both well-being and creativity in the workplace by using those much oft maligned areas of arts and culture? I know, arts and culture in the STEM-based society in which we live. Are you insane? Well, hopefully not, because we're delighted to welcome the placemaking curatorial director of Brookfield Properties to the programme today. That's Saf Williams. How are you, Saf?
I'm really well, Alex. How are you going?
I'm okay, but again, a little bit confused in terms of this, because obviously we're talking about boosting productivity and so on. And this particular study that's been made of over 3,000 office workers in the UK has come up with some interesting results. 63% of 18 to 29-year-olds prefer going to the office to work over working from home, with the number increasing to 3/4 of those who work in offices with a lot of art. So have businesses, companies, universities, institutions got it all wrong? Should they be investing more in installation arts to actually help inspire their workforces?
Well, obviously at Brookfield Properties, we've been investing in the arts for over 30 years. So we have a kind of a long history engaging with art and art installations and increasingly well-being programming in the office space internationally. So we know, incidentally, that people are much happier when they're surrounded by a kind of culturally enriched space. But we thought that it was good to, you know, just to put our kind of to put some more evidence toward this. And so we've commissioned this Art of the Workplace as a first paper that we collaborated with Prospectus and also the School of Life to start to think about some statistics around how much it kind of helps people feel more encouraged to come into the office. As you know, as you said at the beginning, as people come back more and more.
Now, there is obviously that classic cliche, which I think hasn't been consigned as yet to the dustbin of history, that I don't know much about art, but I know what I like. And clearly people have different viewpoints on art. I mean, for some people, Gormley's Angel of the North is an inspirational work of wonder. For others, it's less so. So, I mean, in terms of that, is the style of art, I mean, is it a case of sometimes you need to go for a hydroponic garden? Sometimes you maybe need to actually look for more organic approaches. How can this mixture of art and employee engagement boost people's pride in their workplace?
Well, I think what you say is very right. I think, you know, art for a lot of people is very subjective, and people obviously are interested in completely different things in their homes and what they like to visit on exhibitions on the weekend. So the way that we, I mean, other offices will, you know, deal with that in their own way, but Brookfield Properties has managed that by doing a range of art exhibitions across different styles, and a range of well-being programming across different styles. And we also do seasonal programming. So I'm less interested in doing permanent installations and more exhibitions that might be up for three months, et cetera, at a time, so that we can give a variety of work and artists an opportunity. And some of the things that we have found to be most successful and engaging have been everything from craft exhibitions and workshops, you know, photography exhibitions and launches, sculptures being made on site with the artists in residence for tenants and communities to look at. We've worked with the London Symphony Orchestra on films and choreographers and, you know, young musicians being mentored by some of the greats from the LSO. We've done history walking tours, yoga classes. There's a whole range and myriad of arts and events and well-being courses that we sort of offer to our community and our tenants. So I think the way I try and get around it is you can't make everybody happy, but to show a range. And one of the things I always think, Alex, is even if two people coming into the office say, wow, gee whiz, I really don't like that work, at least they're talking about it and they're engaging with each other. So I quietly feel like I'm still winning.
As curatorial director, I'm sure they'll focus say, yes, but what does she actually do? Does it mean you actually curate the artworks? Do you commission the work that's actually there? Do you do a research in terms of the organisation that you're going into and say, this would be just right for this, we need to have an artist's residence here? What's the general modus operandi, Saf?
All of the things you just mentioned is what I'm up to. So I come up with the art strategy for our properties in London and also in Berlin. We own Potsdamer Platz. And that involves all of the things that you just said. So we tend to do seasonal programming. So around summer and the winter time are sort of our high moments. And it can range from everything from commissioning an artist to do sculptural works into one particular building. Or working, I work with a lot of other curators and experts, whether it be from the Barbican or the Crafts Council. We're in preparations right now for the 4th annual Brookfield Properties Craft Award. So with the Crafts Council and Collect, which is at Somerset House in February, and just looking at kind of a range of different opportunities, artworks and spaces. So whether it's building works, dealing with artists, artist contracts, installing lots of hard hats, steel cap boots and cranes in this job, as well as deep research. And also listening to our tenants. We're working on a Black History Month exhibition right now, which has come from the Black Lawyers Group at one of our law firms. And, you know, they came forward with an exhibition that they were passionate about. So all of those things that you mentioned. Mm-hmm.
And Seth, from your own perspective, are there any particular forms of art that you particularly go for? I mean, are you more of a visual person, a sensory person, an auditory person? Are there different lines? And can you actually match them up? I mean, for instance, here we are, University of Lincoln Siren Radio. Should we actually have some sort of auditory art in there?
Yeah, I think it sort of depends on the space. I have to say, personally, in my work, we tend to go for less sound pieces just because of being in the city and our tenants and the kind of work that they're doing. But most of the big art installations that I'm engaged with out in the public space are what we've affectionately started to call almost adult playgrounds. So they're
meaning, Saf. I mean, you know, in all sorts of ways. I think I'm giving dangerous terminology there, surely.
But big sculptural pieces that people can sit on, have their lunch, you know, like engage with. They can be frames for all sorts of things. We've had live DJ sets, bands around some of these big art installations of an evening or sometimes lunchtime sessions. So we try and create spaces that can be used, in different ways. And
And do you get much responses? I mean, obviously, we've looked at the survey in general and the connection between workplace satisfaction and productivity. Do you ever feel as though actually, yes, job done, sorted, the productivity of that particular organisation has gone up at least 20% result?
Well, I mean, it's a tricky bow, isn't it, as you say, between productivity. I think more what we're trying to do with the study and with our work is we're trying to encourage people to feel happier when they're in their workplace. And, you know, we see that 64% of workers that think that cultural and social events in the workplace kind of help them feel more comfortable in their workspace and perhaps more creative. The level of productivity is probably for a study, a more in-depth study, but I think certainly people feel happier and more, pride in their space, and they want to come in. And particularly for younger generations, there's a lot of benefits to coming in, but having a beautiful office is certainly one of them.
I'm always minded of the fact that when people look at a cluttered series of things in offices, you've got to bear in mind the second law of entropy. The more effort you put into something, the more chaos you cause. But that's another line for another discussion. Saf, how can people actually find out more about Brookfield Properties and your fascinating installation pieces and so on?
They can go to brookfieldproperties.com/ourapproach, and they can download the report there, and that will also direct them to some examples of projects that we've done kind of internationally and particularly in London.
Seth Williams, curatorial director for Brookfield Properties. Keep on installing, Seth.
Thanks, Alex. Will do. Have a great day.
Down to the wire. Set your hopes up way too high.